Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Tomorrow is a full moon Valentine's Day, an excellent time for love and other lunacies. No need to take a narrow view of that, of course. Just take a cue from the Buddha, that big old romantic, and radiate metta, that is, loving kindness, to everyone you meet tomorrow. See what kind of a day you have. This year there's a Valentine's Day campaign going on called Show the Bees Some Love. It's a response to the fact that neonicotinoid pesticides, also called neonics, are killing bees. That's why countries in Europe are banning them. Yet it's been found that these bee-killing pesticides are in more than half of the so-called bee-friendly home garden plants sold at stores like, including, I should say, Home Depot and Lowe's, with no warning to the consumers. So my friends at the Center for Food Safety have teamed up with Friends of the Earth, Beyond Toxics, Pesticide Action Network, Beyond Pesticides, Xerces Society, Credo, Mobilize, SomeOfUs.org, and other groups to ask Home Depot and Lowe's to show the bees some love by stopping selling bee-killing pesticides and garden plants that are pre-poisoned with these harmful chemicals. More than 500,000 people have already signed these petitions, which are going to be delivered tomorrow on Valentine's Day. So if interested, go to the centerforfoodsafety.org or one of the others today and sign the petition. It's a life-preserving Valentine for the bees, without which humans would be in big trouble. Now, last Sunday, there was an article in the education supplement of the Sunday New York Times entitled Love, Actually, which is about the emotional problems observed on college campuses today that are a result of the hookup culture, the emotional numbing it requires, and the vigilance to keep every relationship and even every conversation on a superficial level. I would like to add that from a feminist perspective, it's been dismaying to watch the adolescent culture, not to mention much of the adult culture, move on to the adolescent male model in recent decades, specifically the model of sex with no emotional involvement. That's what teenage boys have always thought they needed, but in fact, male adolescents lag behind the girls in emotional development by several years. So what they actually needed was that socialization built in with high school romance. That is, they had to actually be nice to someone to get a kiss. They learned to build and be in relationships, which is important in all areas of life. Today, though, many of our young people feel the emptiness of what might be called a relationship deficit in many areas. The pain and fragility of that condition has caused most universities to add significantly to the number of psychotherapists available around the clock to students, often posting them in dorms. And they're now, in some campuses, offering workshops about relationship skills. Another factor in this situation, this fragility, is that many effects of a childhood that's passed in what I call the electronic immersion, that is being glued to a screen from a very early age, those effects take their toll, and teachers from the elementary school level on up have been noticing for about 25 years that children whose formative years are saturated with screen time have trouble with social skills, with reading body language, with caring much about other people or relating to them. So this is borne out now by all the surveys of 18 to 34-year-olds, showing that levels of empathy are way down and levels of narcissism are way up. On top of all this, technology is continuing its invasion into the nature of higher education in numerous ways. That is, the experience of becoming educated is becoming very different now. We'll hear from someone who's widely respected for his insights into this development in our society. My guest today is Langdon Winner. He's a political theorist who studies the interactions of technology, politics, and culture. Author of two books, Anonymous Technology and The Whale and the Reactor, and numerous articles, he argues for lively citizen engagement with the possibilities and problems that the new technologies present. His essay, Do Artifacts Have Politics?, is widely regarded as a seminal influence in the study of technology on campuses during the past 30 years. He's a staunch foe of the military's influence on technological change, and he supports open source computing as well as technologies that foster inclusiveness, democratic participation, and care for the earth. Langdon Winner has sometimes expressed his critique in parody and satire, such as the notorious Masked Marauders rock and roll hoax, and more recently, his video skit, Introducing the Automatic Professor Machine, which explores the fantasy that new technology will revitalize education. He's taught at several Xixi universities I won't rattle off here, and he has an endowed chair in humanities and social science at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, and he's writing a book about technology criticism in the 20th century. Plus, I'll just add that he wrote reviews for Rolling Stone back in the day when he was a grad student at UC Berkeley in the 60s. He also has a very interesting and amusing blog, which is at technopolis.blogspot.com. Langdon Winner, welcome to the program.
Charlene, thank you for inviting me.
Well, let's start with your telling the listeners about your video skit, Introducing the Automatic Professor Machine, which, by the way, is posted on YouTube, and I highly recommend. And by way of some context for that wise and amusing performance, I'd like to read a comment you made about technology and education. Quote, "It's very interesting that there's no museum of the history of technology and education. I think the reason is that nobody wants to remember what happened 5 years ago or 15 years ago, because these things have always been failures," unquote. But, your automatic professor is going to seize the initiative, eh?
Yes. Well, you know, I would just say as a bit of a context that the promise of technology in education began in about 1910 when an Australian member of the government visited Thomas Edison and suggested to him that his Edison motion picture machine could be used in the schools. And Edison immediately took to the idea and started a company to produce essentially educational movies. And at one point he was heard to say that once you had schools that were largely based on movies, you couldn't keep the children away even if you ringed the schools with police. So all of this is to say the idea that you can revitalize education with technology is a very old idea, and it's gone through many iterations decade by decade since the early 20th century. My little skit, the context for that was I had been to, in the 1990s, a number of conferences in which the personal computer and the online education notion had taken a big hold. And I gave my talk in which I offered a straightforward criticism of this, saying that it would be costly, ineffective, and would tend to withdraw, let's say, support for public education. And then I was invited to another big conference. That one was, I think, in 1998 at Penn State University. I said, I'm getting tired of doing this, so why don't I just do a version of my criticism as a send-up? So that's where the automatic professor machine was born.
Well, you've really got all the intonations down of the academic speech for those who recognize
it. Well, what happens there, if you watch the thing online, I come out as me, Langdon Winner, and I say, actually when I gave this at Penn State, I said these words. I said, you know, I've always been known as a critic of this, but now my views have changed.
Yeah.
At Penn State, there was a gasp that came up from the audience. But anyway, in the skit and in the video, I go off stage briefly and change into a different suit and tie and come back as I saw it as a kind of Silicon Valley hypester with a product to sell.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway, that skit, I mean, early on it says...
Utopian idea that the huckster lays out?
Yeah, exactly. And he says, well, let's start with the forces shaping education today. And they are, and I'd say these are the same ones we have today in various guises. But he says, these are commodification, the idea that educational products have to be delivered as a commodity.
Of
globalization.
Course.
Globalization, yeah, which is that everything has to be available at every point on the globe. Privatization, which is the things that used to be in public hands serving the public good will now be pushed into the private market. And then finally, digital transformation, that whatever used to be in some other form, let's say a book or a in-person classroom, you know, now it will be in some digital medium. So that's, and then the skit rolls on from there with this increasingly absurd and risible hype, which turns out to be not that different from ones that were actually given back then and now.
Yeah. Alas. Yes, painfully familiar and in the here and now. So I was very taken by a comment you made on your blog where you say, you know, we package the stuff as if you go through a set of courses, that's what matters. It's sort of like, you know, an assembly line and we pour this information into your heads and you get credentialed and go off. And here's just one more quote I'd like to share with the listeners. But I always tell my students at Rensselaer, I say, if you leave this place without a network of friends and colleagues, people your age with interests in the field of knowledge and practice that you have mastered, you leave this place without three or four faculty who would respond to a letter of recommendation request saying why this person's any good, then you've wasted your tuition money, because education is not just about what you have in your head, but some precious things that are not very well understood, unquote. And those unquantifiable things are the relational factors in the educational experience. I have a whole chapter in the book Relational Reality on how important relational elements are in the learning process from preschool on up. But you really address it here in the college classroom, which I thought was very interesting and valuable.
Yeah, you know, that's a point you and I, Charlene, really share, is that things that matter most are found in relationships, which one should try to extend and deepen. And the problem with a lot of digital technology in our time, including in education, is that it tries to replace all of that with a commodity. And the people say, are you anti-technology? And I say, no, not at all. For example, I believe that in the arts, the people engaged in the arts should explore every new possibility that technologies make possible. But when it comes to education, what happens is that the technologies are a medium for commodity and profit making. That's all they ever are. That's all they ever will be. So it turns it into something like a microwave oven or a toaster or a car that you would buy and carry off with you, which I think in any reasonable understanding of education or human life generally is a very sad idea.
Yeah, and you know, I totally agree. And in addition to that, even if it weren't commodified, even if it were owned by a government nonprofit institute or something, it just reduces the whole rich, complex interaction of learning through other people and other media into what'll fit into that binary logic system in the computer and flat screen images. And just the idea of growing up on these shifting flat images all the time has, by many studies, been found to contribute to more superficial and surface thinking. So it's really a morally criminal reduction of the human experience, and we're feeding our young people such a narrow version of this.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that one thing that happens is there, especially middle class and upper middle class families that can afford all of this stuff, each new generation of electronics is presented as sort of the big magic that will make life wonderful. And certainly, you know, something like an iPad has lots of wonderful things that it can do. But, you know, when it comes to connecting people, let's say, with the change of the seasons or the glories of studying a piece of music very deeply as you learn how to play it.
Yeah.
And any number of things you could mention. Our children are shortchanged by the techno-commodity orientation toward the world.
Yeah. And also it's been revealed that a lot of the high-level officers of the technology companies in Silicon Valley send their kids to Waldorf schools. Very high tuition, which is not a problem for them, but no television all the way through K through 12th grade, and, you know, definitely off any devices in the formative years. So they're very much committed to the fact that young children have to learn from tactile exploration, from the arts, from rhythmic dance, from exploring nature,
yeah.
And then,
you know,
into reading and math.
Yeah.
And I assume they teach that as a relationship, you know, the relationship of letters to words, words to paragraphs, paragraphs to pages, stories and numbers. What are numbers about? They're about the relationships among things.
Yeah. Well, at a Waldorf school, you know, in the early grades, when you learn what a triangle is, you go out in a field, and there are 3 points, and you walk them, you know,
uh-huh.
From point one to point two to point three. And they say, this, we've now done a triangle, and the idea is, this is very common in Steiner education, that it isn't the mind alone that learns this.
Uh-huh.
It has to be in the body.
Yeah, bodily experiential learning,
another thing that has to be, you know, taken into account. I think a lot of, for example, we have in public schools, in order to enable sufficient content, which often means computerized content, to be delivered, as we say, they cut out the arts and recess at the younger levels, so we
terrible.
Have more time cramming things into people's heads. And we know, I'm sure you're aware of this, that, you know, let's say you're learning language or mathematics or science in grade school, there's a level of the brain in which information is stored short term as you are in the process of learning. And then what happens is if you get up and walk around or run around for a period of, let's say, a half hour, 45 minutes, the brain takes that and moves it to a deeper and longer-lasting storage, to put it in those terms. And if you just have one class after another and one computer screen followed by a test and so forth, all of that is disrupted, unfortunately.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that a lot of school districts are taking computers out. I cited examples of that in relational reality, where they said it just didn't improve the test scores and it degraded the classroom experience. This is in high school. And I think in some middle school where they'd given them tablets. So it's interesting that people are, as you say, waking up to the difference between the hype and the reality, and also, you know, the damaging effects, which are not mentioned when the positive ones are touted.
Yeah, but, you know, Charlene, here's the other thing. If you have the legacy of failure with these things, and you can go back through motion pictures and tape strips and phonograph records and radio programs that in my grammar school, they used to play radio programs that were supposed to have educational benefit. And then you go through the various iterations of television and computers and so forth. The fact that these educational technologies fail is not a lesson that anyone takes seriously, because it's the seed bed for the next thrust. They say, well, of course, that was just junk, but this thing we have now, the tablet, this everyone should have a tablet, because this is the promise.
Yeah, that's very interesting, isn't it? This is the new best thing.
You know, the very fact that the previous generation of stuff failed is just a justification for plowing on.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'd like to get your views on a big technological development that's starting to emerge here on campuses, and that's this massive open online courses, or MOOCs, MOOCs, and I wonder what you think about them.
Well, I would put it right in some people have said when they've heard about these systems and their applications that the 12-year-old automatic professor machine skit sort of, you know, scoped it all out. Once again, the idea is that something comes through a pipe. Maybe it's a lecture, or maybe it's a set of PowerPoint slides, or a bunch of material, and then you have the accompanying text and so forth. And it's this kind of delivery system for knowledge, which is sort of the same old model repeated. The thing in this case is the word MOOCs is massive open online courses, and so the key word is massive, and you know, they want literally tens of thousands of people to be taking these courses, which, you know, sort of the first ones are free, and then as you worry about things like getting a credential, like a bachelor's degree or a certificate or something like that, then there are means in which, you know, money begins to be extracted. And, you know, fortunately, I think from what I've heard, what I've been reading, the results of the use of MOOCs have been disappointing, at least to universities and colleges that claimed to be delivering a high quality education for, you know, tomorrow's creative students.
Yeah. Well, so Harper's Magazine just arrived yesterday, which I suppose must be the March issue, and in the Harper's Index it said, I don't have it at hand here, but I think it said 49% of the people who enroll for a MOOC course drop out after the first lecture, but that may be because of what you said. The first one's free, but it also said only 4% don't already have a bachelor's degree. In other words, a lot of people trying this are just trying to pick up some additional knowledge rather than use it as a degree path.
Yeah. And indeed, you know, I use the net for all kinds of information, and for what it's worth, as a small-town boy in California, a lot of my early education was buying a stack of paperback books, that most of which I didn't understand, you know, Plato and Aristotle, and I just forced myself to plow through them. But there was a limit to that kind of education, and where the things that really meant something to me, let's say, in my early and middle teens, let's say, was when a teacher would come over and say, you know, that was a good essay you wrote, or you've got some promise.
Right.
And, you know, and I remember those things profoundly.
Yeah.
Where somebody that I'm on your side.
Yeah, again, that relational connection. You know, here's someone who knows, who's making the effort to tell me, maybe I've got it too.
Yeah, and you can't get that staring at your laptop screen with the wizard up front giving the same lecture to 20,000 people.
Right.
It might be a perfectly good lecture, you know.
Yeah.
But that's not what students need. You know, an organization I've been affiliated with over the years, it's also a connected to the Waldorf schools and Steiner education and so forth, is called Alliance for Childhood.
Uh-huh.
They've done wonderful critiques of technology and education, and they begin with a single, simple question about all these things, especially at the K through 12 level. And the question is, and it's one almost never asked by the technology promoters, but the question is, what do children need? You know, that ought to be the, and in my case, I teach college. What do undergraduate students need? What do graduate students need?
Right.
You have to focus on that every day.
Right. Right. Yeah, and the way some people answer that question is so narrow. You know, we need little cogs in our industrial machine. but what do they really need to be fully human and not having all these problems that are arising now? I noticed when I was teaching, I taught mostly face-to-face graduate courses, but then I was asked to teach a few online, so I learned how to do that. And to my surprise, especially with the younger students just out of their BA degrees, because some others were midlife people returning to graduate school or going to graduate school, anyway, especially with the younger graduate students, they were more inclined to say really deep, revealing things in the online discussions than they would. They're too shy to put their hands up in a classroom and say anything. People might be looking at them. So it was very interesting to me that was a milieu that was so comfortable to them, even though to me it seems like a more exposed situation. You know, anybody could copy it and send it around the world. So I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, sometimes people feel more emboldened in these situations. Well, of course, they're also the kinds of things they've been growing up with, you know.
Exactly.
It's very
comfortable to them.
Life on the screen, yeah. In my college teaching, I've developed a series of very, very simple methods to root students out. Everybody has to write a paper with only five or six sentences for each meeting of a discussion class, and they have to have a question they want to pose. And then I just go around the room. My expectation is they have done the readings, and they have something to say.
Yeah.
That's what I expect.
Yeah, to engage thinking.
Do.
That's the art of teaching, exactly. Well, we have to pause right here for the break. This is Charlene Spretnak on All Together Now, speaking with my guest, Langdon Winner. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Langdon Winner. The address for his blog is technosphere.blogspot.com. That's technosphere.blogspot.com.
Charlene.
Yes.
It's actually Technopolis.
Oh, you're right. I said it right the first way at the beginning of the program and wrong the second time, so
yeah.
Right you are.
Technopolis, yeah.
Well, okay, Professor, got me there.
That's okay.
So I wanted to move into another of your areas, because in the field of rhetoric, there's a phrase, God terms, which is meant to characterize the central aspirations of a particular historical period. And you've said that in your view, today's so-called God term is innovation. So why do you think so?
Yeah, well, you can compare it to other God terms. Maybe in the 18th century, it was progress. Throughout the 19th century, it might have been revolution, or in America, it was frontier. And these terms still rattle around, and they have a kind of aura of wonder and change that's going to be good. And in our time, I mean, we just have all of these institutes and organizations and corporations that say, well, what we are doing here is innovation. And this innovation is a change that brings renewal. And to be doing that, of course, is quite a wonderful thing. There are courses in engineering schools and business schools and all kinds of, you know, executive seminars and so forth that teach formulas for eliciting innovation. And, you know, to be innovative is a characteristic that, you know, is cherished. We encourage young people to take risks and think outside the box and to be innovative. And I've been hearing this for quite a long while. As other terms, let's say in the 1980s, the big term was competitiveness.
Mm-hmm.
You still hear that sometimes, but it sort of faded in significance. But innovation is now what everyone worships. It's an object of veneration. So after a while, I began thinking, what's really going on here? And the way I've come to see it is the sort of crown jewel in the ideology of neoliberalism, and this sort of swept through the business world and through our foundations and universities and colleges. And the neoliberalism, the thing is that the market should be making the decisions, that private entities work much better than public entities.
Mm-hmm.
And that ultimately success is measured by coming up with a saleable product like an iPhone or an iPad, or coming up with something like Amazon that makes, you know, billions of dollars with a new approach to selling books or other goods. And my students, for example, I teach in an engineering school, they all aspire to be innovators, and I sort of hope they do, and I hope they're quite successful. But then you look at the other side of the coin, which is that the innovation is a kind of moral discourse. You know, when have you done well, and when have you done poorly, and what are the consequences? And if you listen to what people are saying closely, the logic is, well, you should think outside the box and be innovative, and if you succeed in that, you've made it in this world. You'll have a rich and fulfilling personal life. Your country or your company will be full of hosannas for you. But the other side of the moral equation is that if you aren't innovative, if you don't come up with the next iPhone or iPad or with something else that Stephen Jobs might have invented, if you're not innovative in a world like this one, we regret to tell you that you deserve the wretched fate that awaits you. That's ultimately the moral logic of innovation. Innovate or die, basically.
Well, I think listening to you, it clearly has the connotations of, you know, our blind faith in technological progress and the next best thing that's invented. We can just forget the past because, after all, who cares? What else arose in my mind was the distinction between innovation and creativity. And I read recently that one of the SUNY campuses, I don't know, maybe it's Buffalo, but since 1967 they've taught creativity studies.
Oh, yeah.
And it was very interesting because, you know, if we would teach children, you're going to encounter problems, and you need to get into the habit of designing a solution to the problem. You know, you're hungry, you go into the kitchen and design a sandwich. You have a problem with a friend, you design a way to solve the problem and resolve it. You, this one boy invented some little closure device. He said the doors in the restroom in the middle school are always broken, and this little device I've invented, I call it the restroom watchman, you know, holds the door closed.
I saw that. It was a very
good habit, you know, to say, as I say, as a habit of I encounter problems and I think about solutions. And then there's this different spin. This is creativity with innovation, is that forward movement. What's good about the past? Nothing much. Do we learn from it? Are you kidding? You know, we're moving forward with the new. And it's so caught up in that ideology, as you say. And but there's also under appreciation of problem solving and creativity.
Yeah, and the other thing that I think that it tends to discount is, other approaches to working toward the well-being of the community, the public good, like, for example, getting a plan together that addresses the needs of the poor and most vulnerable in our society, you know, to sort of say, well, maybe we ought to tax the rich a bit more.
Or restore the taxes they used to pay.
Exactly. Or let's tackle global warming directly by taking steps to do some very simple things to cut greenhouse emissions.
That's right.
You know, we don't take those rather well-known pathways to address human needs, but instead we say, no, what we need is innovation. So we'll have some laboratories or new, corporate seminars or whatever. And what this means is, for one thing, that if you have immediate problems like global warming or the energy crisis that faces us, if you're waiting for innovation, you say, well, if we assemble the right teams and get the right grants, spend the right amount of money and bring the right minds together, maybe in 12 or 15 years we'll have come across really wonderful innovations that can solve this global warming problem.
Yeah.
Well, so it's a kind of strategy of temporizing also. And because innovation has become our knee-jerk response to the need for change, then other, you know, much more obvious and I think useful pathways to change are neglected.
Exactly, because it's so closely associated with the manufacturing of devices and, you know, smart city meters to set the lights. And, well, if people are still feeling alienated in the cities, we're still going to have big problems. You know, we need to find ways to repair the social fabric, because that's what humans need. Humans are profoundly relational beings, and that means face-to-face interactions. It doesn't mean just typing into a screen. So there's definitely an overweighting of all the non-technological ways. I mean, most people you talk to that I've met from, you know, Silicon Valley mentality, they just think politics, you know, oh God, that baggage is still there. Instead of, you know, we live in this democracy and every generation could see it as, you know, how can we improve the system, that it's always going to be evolving and, you know, there can be ways to make it more and more participatory and it's alive, it's organic. But that's not valued. All that's valued is the device that can be sold, which will supposedly solve our problems, and we'll be these passive recipients of it, which is, very dangerous for what hasn't been done politically.
Yeah, I am on Twitter, by the way, Langdon W. And last week I posted what I think is my favorite tweet so far, and it fits with what we've been saying here. It said, it's sort of like, I think of tweets as sort of like fortune cookies without the cookie. the little paper message inside. And this one said, thinking outside the box is the new box. And that's what we are doing. Rather than rely on, let's say, enriching democracy and revitalizing citizenship, or going back to tried and true methods of educating the whole person, you know, we're looking for outside the box solutions, and if we can get to those, then we might be able to do something. Otherwise, we're just paralyzed, probably.
It does seem to be the case, and we're on drift in a pretty disastrous direction. Well, I wanted to ask you about another subject.
Sure.
You've said that material artifacts actually reflect and express important political changes. How do you see that?
Well, I think that that's sort of what a lot of my career as a political scientist has been based upon. And when I first announced the idea, when I asked the question, do artifacts have politics, and answered the question, yes, many people thought it was just crazy and absurd, because everyone knows that technical devices and systems are neutral.
Yeah, value-free.
of how you use them. So I began to give examples about ways in which, let's say, the projects of the great builder Robert Moses in New York, his roads and bridges and beaches and even swimming pools, contained a particular kind of agenda which was heavily weighted in social class and even racial discrimination. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of, you had designs to separate the white and more wealthy citizens around New York from the black and the poor. And you can just sort of see it in the structures that he built.
Mm-hmm.
And this idea, which seemed nuts when I first began writing about it, has now become more or less coin of the realm, and people quibble with me about which theory and which case studies best, you know, work this through. But I think that it's a kind of idea that you could see it already in other thinkers, like the great Lewis Mumford and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
I just happened to have pitched it in a way that makes sense to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well,
one of my favorite examples, by the way, let me give you a good book everybody out there could read. It's called Contested Waters by Jeffrey Wiltse, W-I-L-T-S-E, and it's a history of American swimming pools. And I won't go into any detail on this, but he begins about 1860, 1870, and traces how municipal swimming pools change according to different theories and ideas of what disease is, who's a respectable citizen. The climax of the book is when he shows that they finally get the design of swimming pools for the whole family, these leisure pools, recreational pools that were built about from 1920 onward, and until that time, when the other kinds of pools, you had men swimming together, including blacks and whites. But as soon as you build these new leisure pools, the blacks are kicked out. And there are reasons for that, which he goes into. But essentially, this book about a simple thing like a swimming pool. It shows how the shape of the pool changes, how the social relationships change, how the politics changes, right up to the present day where, you know, those who can afford it have a pool in their backyard. And he, Wiltse correctly says, this is one of the ways in which we have shut down public space and the common good.
Mm-hmm.
Eventually, just said, in the way we build swimming pools. To hell with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Interesting.
That's a great.
I wanted to ask you at the end here about the book you're working on the history of technology criticism in the 20th century. It seems to me so difficult for the criticism and, you know, even very replicable studies done to about damage to make a dent into actual practice. I'm thinking of the fact that the American Academy of Pediatricians a couple of years ago put out their guideline that children under 2 years of age should not be exposed to television. Now, I wonder how many parents in the United States know that, just know about that guideline, whether they want to ignore it or not. And also, you know, all the studies that show that children that have a television in their bedroom read less well in first, second, third grade. They lag in reading skills. So, again, I'm wondering, here's the studies, here's the critique, here are the facts, folks. How many people are aware of this? Because the Kaiser Foundation showed that there's a huge proportion of children who have a television in their bedroom. So when you look at the history of technology criticism in the 20th century, was there ever a time or an area that actually was listened to, or are we always rolled over by this juggernaut of a belief in modern progress through technology?
Yeah, well, I think it's spotty, but I think obviously the greatest success really came with the criticisms of and the findings.
We just have about a minute here, but go ahead.
Rachel Carson and Silent Spring. I mean, that was a critique viciously fought by the chemical industry of a set of practices which were destructive.
Yeah.
And you can go through
viciously fought in personal attacks against her, which should be said,
Yeah. Now, on the other hand, those who, like Seymour Melman, the industrial engineer professor at Columbia, those who criticized the influence of the military on our technology base, people warning that if we can continue investing in this rather than revitalizing industrial work, those people were largely neglected, right?
Yeah.
We've just continued on with the stupid military-industrial complex.
I know. We can't afford to listen to this stuff. Anyway, I'm sorry to say we're out of time, but this has been so interesting. And Langdon Winter, thank you so much for coming on the program.
Thank you for asking me, Charlene. I appreciate it.
Okay, let's amble over to the Arts Corner and see what we have for Valentine's Day program here. This is a poem by one of the wits of the Algonquin Round Table back in the 1920s, Dorothy Parker. And this is from her collection called Enough Rope. And this particular poem is about love and regrets. It's called A Very Short Song. Once, when I was young and true, someone left me sad, broke my brittle heart in two, and that was very bad. Love is for unlucky folk. Love is but a curse. Once there was a heart I broke, and that, I think, is worse. Well, for our Valentine's song, I happened to read an article a while ago in which a journalist was bemoaning the lost skill of writing letters, and even, for many of the young millennials, the loss of knowing how to write cursive letters or write in longhand because it isn't taught in many elementary schools anymore. So he noted that among the losses are the phenomenon of writing love letters. Oh, dear. So I'd like to speak to the young men who might be listening. Do your part here to save what's left of literacy and write a love letter. To inspire you, I'm going to play a song about a woman who's received a love letter, apparently quite an effective one. Note that you cannot elicit this kind of response from a tweet or a text message. No. You need to express your charming personality on paper with your very own handwriting.
And here's what might well happen in response. This is Ketty Lester with her big hit from 1962, Love Letters Straight from Your Heart. Here it is.
Love letters straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart. I'm not alone in the night. When I can have all the love you write, I memorize every line, and I kiss the name that you sign. Love letters straight from your heart. I memorize every line, and I kiss the name that you sign. Straight from your heart.
That was Ketty Lester with Love Letters Straight from Your Heart. See what I'm talking about, guys? So get with the program and put pen to paper. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archives. If you like this program, please go to iTunes and like it there. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Now, I have an announcement about my next three scheduled programs on February 27th, March 13th, and March 27th. I'm taking a book leave for these coming weeks to finish writing a book that will be out this fall, which I'll tell you about later on. While I'm on the book leave, PRN will play some of my archival tapes, and my co-host, Eleanor LeCain, will be here live on the alternate Thursdays as usual. I'll be back live on April 10th. Eleanor's guest next week will be Jennifer Lawless, director of the Women and Politics Institute at American University, talking about why women are still only about 20% of elected officials, why it matters, and what can be done about it. Thanks for joining us. This is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now. Now that we know.